kids down there, the fourth half of the way. Anybody who sees the positive that way, half of the way seems inconsistent and maybe contradictory. Chachma is intelligence, lay is emotion. It'd be presumptuous for me to lead this into where my rabbi represents both. I don't think he would want me to say it. I think it's true, but I'll tell you, I was zocha to have a Rosenberg as my rabbi before he was a Rosh Yeshiva in YU. It turns out the Makreya was against the rules.
But,
I then went to a law firm for Rosh my rabbi, to the extent that one of the reasons not to leave that law firm was not to give that shiur. And to me, where it comes from is, I've heard shiurim from a Rosenberg that was so intellectually overwhelming that they actually moved my neshama. It's a great source for us to have a Rosh Hashanah here today to hear Shia.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the kind words. And the feeling is mutual. It was a pleasure. Again, I feel a little bit peculiar. I think it's the first time I've ever been in the Shivat Har Etzion where I didn't start off with a Shir in Hebrew. And a real shiur, but the nature of this particular trip and the time constraints that we're under, even before we got stuck in traffic, which contributed even further to those time constraints, so makes this, I guess, a mostly an exclusively American event. So hence the English language. So I thought I would do is again, we don't have so much time. I know people want to sometimes like to ask questions. I vaguely remember that. So, just start off with just a brief Dvar Torah about the upcoming holiday of Purim. Mishenichnas Adar Marvin Besimcha. So, the implication is that already from the beginning of Adar, there is an element of the overflow, or the preparation, or both. And itself is an interesting question, the relationship between overflow and preparation of Purim. And partially the question is why that is so. I'm not going to go into the details of that question. How that differs with the issue of Shloshim Yom Lefnei Achag, Shalom Vedorshim Achag. The Rav Yoh and others, and Bali Tosis, and Megillah Navdalid relate a little bit to that question. We'll take the assumption that they are a little bit different. Obviously the time frame is different. Moreover, Shalom Vedorshim is different than Marbin, which implies that there's already a beginning of the commemoration and the celebration. And that, of course, makes Divrei Torah in preparation for Purim perfectly legitimate and valid. Not that we needed to validate it. So what I'd like to speak about just very briefly is one phrase in the Megillah. In the very end of the Megillah, so we're told, almost to the end, Perek Tes of the Megillah is dedicated to the structuring of the institution of Purim. In other words, how is the celebration going to be executed? Is there going to be a Megillah? Is it going to be a Yom Tov or not? If you look at the whole Perek Tes, the story is over, and deliberations have begun, entered into complex, almost negotiations, as to how the celebration of the Dori Doros will be accomplished. And at the very end of that Perek, Perek has, I think, 32 psukim. Perek Yud, which comes afterward, is just about the post-history of Purim. But the last few psukim that discuss the character of Purim, where we find a very strange phrase, Divrei Samos Vizak Kosam. And if you read the psukim, just shout. It's very difficult to understand what it's doing there, what it refers to, what it means. So I just want to share very briefly two perspectives, each of which requires much more elaboration and has important implications for how we look at the day and also how we celebrate it. The first is the suggestion by some Rishonim that Divrei Samot Vizak Hasam is a reference to the Dalit Somos. This is quoted in quite a few of the Rishonim, both on the Parshanut side of things in Esther, as well as some of the Rishonim in Tainis, who deal with a very intriguing problem, which we'll get back to in just a minute. What do the Dalit Tainos have to do, Tzomos, have to do with Purim and the establishment of Purim as a holiday and the Megillah as a public Kriya? That's a good question. So some explain that the Dalit Tzomos are a paradigm, in a certain sense, to solve the problem which may have been an obstacle for establishing such a holiday, namely the problem of Baltosif. How do we know that in a post Matan Torah era, right, that one can add a celebration, a festival to the Torah? We know that Baltosif, at least according to the Rambam and Ramban, includes not only Hey Totafos or Hey Minim, but it also includes being Bodeh, Chag, Milibo. You can't just invent holidays as sincere as you are. Right? Simulations are the kind of things that are frowned on in the world of Halacha, in the world of Torah. So the legitimacy of there being the Purim, and that's certainly reflected in the Gemara and Megillah, Kisvuni Vildoros, and some of the discussions connected with it. How can you have a Kriyas HaMegillah? How can you have a festival, a celebration, whether it's a Yom Tov, whether it's Simcha Mishnah or Mishnah Simcha, whether it includes Matonis Levyonim or doesn't, the changes in the Psukim that I'm alluding to in Perek Tes, again, that I don't have time to discuss. Whatever it is, just the very enterprise of having a holiday, having a Kriya, having a Sefer, like Megillah, is problematic. And therefore, the reference is Divrei Tzomos V'Zaak Asam. That's the paradigm. The idea that there can be Tzomos, but only Tzom D'Araisas Yom Kippur, how can there be Dalet Tzomos? Where does that come from? Divrei Kabbalah, Divrei Nevi'im. The idea seems to be that while the Torah is closed in the sense of Baltosif or Baltigra, the application of the concepts of Torah Sheba'al Peh, right, is the true challenge of Torah Sheba'al Peh. And that's not a hosafa to the Torah. That constitutes the Hayim Kiyum and fulfillment of the Torah itself. Part of Torah Hashem Tanima is understanding when to apply, when to not extend in the Baltosif sense, but extend in the application sense, the principles of the Torah. And therefore the Divrei Tzomos V'Zaak Asam is the paradigm on the Moed festival side for there being a Kriya, a holiday, with everything that goes along with it. Of course, the question arises, this is the final word, this is what you want to emphasize in the context of something like Megillas Esther. The final focus in Purim is going to be the paradigm of Tzomos. However, if we take the perspective of Kimu v'Kiblu, Kimu Masha Kiblu Kvar, the idea that Purim isn't just a day of celebration, but in some respects is a second or maybe a third Kabbalas HaTorah. Famous Gemara in Masechet Psachim, Tasamachesimid Beis, which discusses the problem of Kula Lachem and Kula Lashem. Normally we paskin that a festival, a Yom Tov, a Shabbos, is a day of balance, a day of equilibrium, Chatzi Lachem, Chatzi Lashem. However, there are certain days of the year where we accentuate the extreme. Yom Kippur is Kula Lashem, Shavuos is Kula Lachem, because it's Yom Shenitna B'Torah. And Purim also is a day of Kula Lachem. According to one Girsa, that quoted in the Mordechai, it's picked up by the Beis Yosef and others, the explanation for Purim alongside Shavuos being a day of Kula Lachem is because it too is a Yom Shenitna B'Torah. Why is it a Yom Shenitna B'Torah? That's not the normal way that we look at Purim. But as we know, the Gemara says in Shabbos, Kima v'kiblu, kima masha kiblu kvar, the acceptance of, the wholehearted acceptance, the enthusiastic acceptance of Torah Sheba'al Peh took place dafka on Purim. But to explain a little bit better, or a little bit more profoundly, what this means, perhaps we can suggest that that's the emphasis of Divrei Tzomos V'Zaak Asam. Because by becoming aware or validating this principle, that there's a difference between a Tosefes, a Baltosif, which is really Megareya, right? Something which seems like an addition, but which undermines the integrity of the system. And a proper, valid, necessary application, something which establishes that the Torah that we received is a living, dynamic Torah, one which imposes upon us obligations, but at the same time establishes values which need to be applied in all sorts of circumstances, wisely, and of course with Torah leadership. Divrei Tzomos V'Zaak Asam, as a paradigm justifying Purim as a holiday, itself reflects the methodology of Torah Sheba'al Peh, which in turn, I'm suggesting, is the Kimu V'Kiblu, kima masha kiblu kvar, which is what establishes it as the equivalent as yom shenitna bo Torah. I mentioned the other night, I don't know how many people were there on Motzoi Shabbos, I just mentioned it very briefly, we have in Mahara Malava Malka, the comment of the Maral who says, slightly different shot, but one which I think integrates well with this idea, that the Kivu Masha Kiblu Kfar is based on the idea that whenever you add to the system of the halacha, everything changes within it. It ripples across the system. My formulation, but I think his idea, I think that's what he means. Whenever you add an important element, a new dimension to the system, it affects everything that preceded it. It redefines the totality. Not because that totality is shaky and unstable, but quite to the contrary. It adds an element of depth, it adds a perspective which reflects upon the whole system, the integrity of the whole system. And in this sense, divrei tzavos v'zah kasam, knowing how to apply, knowing how to distinguish between Bal Tosif, which is Bal Tikra on the one hand, and at the same time, to apply in a way which is meaningful the principles of Torah Shebaal Peh, which is effective in expanding and deepening Torah, that principle is truly a second Kabbalah Satara. But I think there's a second theme as well. Divrei Tzavos V'zah Kasam, according to the Rambam in Hilchos Tainis, and according to the Raivid, certainly is quoted by the Ran in Masechet Tainis, refers to Tainis Esther. And partially is used by the Raivid to solve a very important conundrum. We'll speak about it just for 2 minutes. We know that the Megillah is referred to in the work Megillas Tainis, and we know that Megillas Tainis, the work which collected the various holidays that were commemorated, was batel. It was a time when the holidays of Megillas Tainis were no longer binding. However, the Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah that there were 2 exceptions, the ones that we know, Chanukah and Purim. The question is, if that's true, part of the Megillas Tainis scheme is that Devarim Shelefneim and Lachreim, or one of, at least Lefneim in some cases, are also prohibited from Hesped and Tainis. And if it's true that Chanukah and Purim, I'll focus on Purim, is an exception to the Bittul of Megillas Tainis, then how could there ever be a Tainis Esther? Right? Because the day before Purim, Yud Gimel is Tainis Esther, and it's a day before Megillas Tainis, which should be prohibited. So, and the question is, how could that be? All sorts of answers were given by the Rishonim. Tosfos Tainis Tafid Ches is one answer. There are all sorts of answers. I'm not going to go through all of them, because I understand that there's an interest in questions, and we'd like to get to them. The view of the Raivid, however, is based on the pasuk Divrei Tzomos V'Zah Kasam, that the Tainus of Tzom, the Tzom of Tainus Esther is different than other Tzomos. Other Tzomos are about Abel and maybe Midarkei HaTshuva, to use the Rambam's famous formulation. Tainus Esther is Zecher L'Neis Shanasa LaEsther or L'Mordechai V'Shushan Avira, which is the Raivid's way of saying that Tainus Esther is a Kiyum in Simchas Purim. It integrates into Purim itself. This is also the interpretation apparently of the Rambam. Divrei Tzomos V'zah Kasam refers to Tainus Esther. The Rambam in Hilchos Tainis says this. And the general theme is also underscored by the famous Shita of Rabbeinu Tam. Gemara says in the beginning of Gilah, Bizmanehem, Zmanim Harbe Tiknu Chachamim. You can read the Megillah, Yud Aleph, Yud Beis, Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet, Tezvav. Zmanim Harbe Tiknu Chachamim. Then the Gemara tries to figure out how we know that. After all, it's Rabbim, that includes 2. How do you get all of the days in there without details? So the Gemara says, listen, you don't have to prove all the days because Yud Gimel is covered anyway because it's Yom Kihila Lakol. Yom Shenikalu Bo Yisrael. What does that mean? Rashi says it's the day where everybody got together and sharpened their knives, I guess, and their pistols, got ready to take revenge and self-defense. That was the day that is referred to. Rabbeinu Tam, on the other hand, says it's the day of Tainus Esther. When you think about it, that's quite remarkable, because the Gemara is trying to prove that you can say the Megillah, you can read the Megillah and fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyas HaMegillah on any of these days. So the fact that it's Tainus Esther, a day of fasting, a day of seeming sadness, a day of crisis? That's a reason to be able to read the Megillah on that day? Seems strange. Almost as strange, right, as the final word practically in the formulation of the Kriya and the Chag of Purim in the Megillah and the end of Parakes being Divrei Tzamos V'Zach HaSam. Even if it's true that it's a reference, or especially if it's true it's a reference to Tainus Esther, the question is, and that's what the Megillah wants to leave us with? If I asked you, any of you in the crowd, you know, you have 3 words, 5 words, I'll give you 10 words, right? Divrei Tzamos V'Zach HaSam, even less than that. You know, so succinctly, right, crystallize the character of Purim. You have to leave me with some final message. What's it going to be? That there's Tainus Esther? That there's no Baal Tosif if you apply the Torah Shabbat Baal Peh properly? Well, the former, I already explained, yes. It's a day of Kabbalah Satorah. That's really the greatness of Purim. Fine. The Tzom? An understanding of what Purim is really all about will establish that the Kiyum of Tainus Esther and of Purim is really one and the same. And that justifies the position of Rabbeinu Tam, of the Rambam, of the Raivid, despite the differences between them. And it's reflected in the world of Halacha as well. You find, for example, according to the Raivid, that a Muberes is obligated to fast on Purim. You don't necessarily fast in this way, but haven't achieved this Raivid. Even though Muberes is not obligated to fast on some of the other Tzomos. The same Raivid felt that if you read the Megillah, Mibod Yom, number one, you can read the Megillah after Plaga Mincha on Tainus Esther, and after you read the Megillah, you can eat. The same Raivid felt, again, this is very much the short version, that if you didn't hear the Kriyas HaMegillah, you have to continue fasting. What I'm trying to highlight, if you ask me the question, does the Raivid think that the Tainus of Tainus Esther is more Mekel or more Machmir than other Tainus? We'd be hard-pressed to give an answer. Muberes, yes. Right? That's Chomer. You can't eat until you hear the Megillah, even if the day is over? That's Chomer. You can read the Megillah, which is supposed to be read on Yud Dalet, on Yud Gimel, after Plaga Mincha. Plaga Mincha is not Erev. I'm not talking about Bein HaShemoshos. I'm not talking about Shkia before Tzeis. And you can break your fast, possibly, on Yud Gimel itself, once you've heard the Kriyas HaMegillah. That's an amazing kula. Which is it? The answer is, I think the Raivid l'shitaso, it's neither a kula nor a chumra. The idea is that there's a continuum between Tainus Esther and Purim. It isn't that one is the background of the other. One is the context, right, which sharply demarcates or contrasts to the other. Rather, both of these are part and parcel of the commemoration of Purim. And why is that so? Because Purim is a holiday which focuses on the concept of Hashkacha, on the idea that there is no Yiyush. The Rambam very beautifully, before he begins Yad HaChazaka, talks about Baal Tosif, actually, to bring both themes together, talks about Megillah and Chanukah, and it's a very beautiful peroration where he says, the purpose of Purim and Chanukah, but especially Purim, is to establish that no matter how dire the circumstances, Klal Yisrael should never give up. Klal Yisrael should never lose faith that the Ribbono Shel Olam will find a way to support Torah and Klal Yisrael. Basically, that's the song of Shoshanas Yaakov. They tell a story, I've seen it, I don't know if it's true or not, that's, you know, I think this is a story told by Rabbi Michal Feinstein, the son-in-law of Rabbi Elwald, that Rabbi Elwald once turned to him and he asked him, what's the pshat in Shoshanas Yaakov? I guess he meant beyond the Niger, he wanted to know what the idea was. So he started explaining the words and, you know, trying to explain the ideas, and Rabbi Elwald kind of waved them away, and he said, you can only understand the pshat of Shoshanas Yaakov if you really read the Rambam in his Hakdama to Yad HaChazaka. Shalikalmo lanetzach kol achosin bach is a special kiyum in Purim. The idea that leich kenosa Yehudim, the idea that tefillah really works, that in a time of crisis, the Ribbono Shel Olam imo anochi b'tzara, that hashgacha is a foundation and a principle in Yahadus, all of these are established in the Megillah and in Purim. The extra heightened consciousness that we have, Adalayada, is meant for us to be able to feel, even if we can't articulate intellectually, precisely that. And therefore, it's Dafka, the integration of the Tzom, Leif Knos HaYehudim, and everything that it represents with Purim, that constitutes the truly unique element of Purim. And that's something which requires a final word. Divrei Tzomos V'Zach Pasam. If you really want to sum it up, it's not the drinking, it's not the party, it's not the mishteh, that's all part of it. But it's Divrei Tzomos V'Zach Pasam. It's the idea that the Tzom is part and parcel of the Kiyum. And if that's really true, it sheds light on many aspects, all the aspects maybe, of the Megillah and the Purim. And it also explains why Mishenichnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha. It's not the regular din of Shol and B'Darshan. It's the idea that in order to appreciate the Hashkacha and the power of Tefillah and the idea that Klal Yisrael has the special protection of the Rabbonu Shel Olam, that's not something you turn on either Tainus Esther or the day after, the day of Purim or Shushan Purim. It's something which you have to prepare for in advance and begin to think about so you can fully be equipped to capitalize on the opportunity of Purim. Okay. So we'll stop here on the Dvar Torah part. And if anybody has any questions about the Dvar Torah or about, I guess, other things, I'm happy to answer. If you don't have any questions, that's fine too. No questions? Yeah.
What do you think should be, as we approach the end of the year, what are the messages we should be taking with us as we leave Yeshiva, or a year from now if we stay Shana Ben?
Well, two different...
In general, what are
the... Well, I think the bigger question is, what is the purpose of coming to learn in Yeshiva in Israel? And, what are you trying to aspire to, while you're here? And whatever that is, right, that will be what you want to retain. With emphasis, at the end of your year, or maybe motivate you, to continue and to stay and further. And I think it's a very good question. One's goals obviously should be to deepen one's Avodas Hashem, and that in multiple ways. Obviously, primarily what you do in any good classical yeshiva, and Yeshivat Har Etzion is certainly qualifies for that. Again, usually when I begin my Hakdama in Hebrew, I'd also take opportunity to thank the yeshiva for inviting me and to mention that I too am a boger of Yeshivat Har Etzion and a Talmud of Mori V'Rabbi, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and of course the late lamented Rabbi Yehuda Amital, Zichrono Livracha, and benefited greatly from being here and also had the schus of having my children come here. So I know that the focus in Yeshivat Har Etzion, as it should be in any other yeshiva, is Talmud Torah. Plain and simple, straightforward, but of course, incredibly, enriching, exciting, hopefully. Something that deepens one of Avodas Hashem. The focus has to be on the Talmud Torah. On the development of skills, of course, both in Bekiyus and Iyun, in reading and in thinking. Being exposed to the grandeur of Torah on a different level than obviously previously experienced in the certain hadragah development in people's progress in all studies, and that's true in Torah as well. So primarily you come here, and to any other good yeshiva, to develop these skills and this appreciation for the depth of Torah, for the preciousness of Torah, to develop the idea that Torah is a value system, something which should be transformative to your personality, to develop eventually, you don't want to be presumptuous, you don't get this right away, but what the Rav used to call, or what the Rav defined as the Isha Halacha kind of persona, where your involvement with your learning and your commitment to your learning is such that you surrender to its categories, that you start thinking, like a Ben Torah, where the Torah becomes a prism, for your thoughts, behavior, the way you assess and evaluate things. So that's, you know, primarily what we're supposed to be doing. Obviously, it's a very lofty goal and a demanding one, and it takes a lot of time. It probably takes more than 2 years. Luckily, it's a process that begins, you know, hopefully earlier than when you come here. And if it doesn't, for some people who are, let's say, less involved or less appreciative, you know, in their high school or previous careers. So to catch up a little bit and to begin that process. But certainly, this is just, you know, one stage, you know, in a lifelong quest. The most successful yeshivot in the world don't want you to, you know, end your learning when you leave there or to see it as the high point. You know, the true success of an excellent learning experience is the sense that you've gained a great deal, that you're, you know, transformed in the process, and that the next step is the new beginning of a continuing quest. Anybody who, you know, leaves with a sense of yish, you know, this is the heights that he will reach, you know, is, you know, involved in kind of self-fulfilling prophecy of doom, or at least of mediocrity. And in the context of Talmud Torah, mediocrity is doom sometimes as well. So on the Talmud Torah level, it's to develop skills for sure, to develop appreciation of what Torah can be, and to develop the will and the determination, right, to build upon your experiences here and to go mala mala, mechayel achayel, to the next yeshiva experience. You know, I'm here mitam yeshiva somedi Yitzchok Hanan, so I should say that we hope many of you will continue with us, you know, across the ocean. At the same time, clearly, Talmud Torah is not only an intellectual pursuit or even only a spiritual academic pursuit, but being in yeshiva climate affords the opportunity to develop other aspects of your Avodas Hashem as well. And certainly in tefillah, an appreciation of other mikzos haTorah, whether it be Tanakh or Makshava. Again, I'm a classicist. I think most of the focus and most of the time should be, you know, the Gemara B'Iyun and everything that goes with it. But classically, you know, the Chav Dalet Svarim are a necessary component of one's development. As much depth and breadth and values to be gained from a serious study of Tanakh and Makshava. And again, any good yeshiva affords that opportunity, each yeshiva in its own way, and again, it's something that should be built on. The tefillah part, for sure, is connected with the bigger question, maybe the biggest question, that is the development of Yiras Shamayim. The principle of Yiraso Kodemus L'Chokmaso, that you know, the learning is all amazing, but of course, the precondition for good learning, and also for meaningful learning, is the sense that this is really a Dvar Hashem. It's a way of connecting to the Ribono Shel Olam. It's the solution to the philosophical conundrum. You know, how can, you know, puny, limited man have a relationship with his omnipotent and omniscient creator? Ratzach HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Zakos Es Yisrael, L'Fikach Kibbutz Lehem Torah Mitzvos. Ribono Shel Olam gave us the answer by giving us a mechanism, a blueprint, the Torah, right, to reach him with. The Achdus Hamaskil, the Hamuskal. And when you see learning in that way, so then there's a certain convergence, the grandeur of the intellectual enjoyment, the thrill, together with the sense that this is something that is meaningful. It's a way of developing Torah values, becoming a Torah personality. And all of that is part of the Yiraso, which is Kodemus al Chokhmaso. And you're behaving in a certain way, having certain aspirations, identifying with Klal Yisrael, identifying with other members of Klal Yisrael, which is different sometimes than simply identifying with Klal Yisrael. So these are multiple ambitious agendas, and we definitely seek to accomplish a lot while we're in this kind of yeshiva environment. But, as I say, in all of them, it's just the beginning of the quest, and it's a lifelong quest to be continued in other yeshiva environments, or depending on what decisions one makes in life, you know, in a family context, in a community context, in a vocational context as well. I'm not sure if that's what you wanted to ask. You could follow up. Probably with a long answer to a short question. Yeah.
I should want to pose the question of whether or not he should stay on a bed.
I think, listen, you have to assess, you know, the pros and the cons. I happen to be a huge fan of Shabbat. The truth is, I'm positioned, you know, and that's the proper word, you know, uniquely, you know, to comment on this problem, because I didn't stay for Shana Bet, but I also didn't leave after Shana Aleph. The truth is, I came in the middle of the year and I stayed a year and a half. But that's just beside the point. In most cases, I think people who come for Shana Aleph, listen, there are all sorts of circumstances. There are family issues, there can be all sorts of you know, pressures and counter pressures. So I'm speaking just generally. But generally speaking, I think when people come their first year, you know, there's a certain measure of adjustment. Time period. People, even if they, you know, have been learning previously, are serious, are interested from day one, let's say, to capitalize. That's not always true either, because people, you know, might be interested, but they're not always, you know, in a frame of mind, don't have the, you know, experience or the wherewithal to do that. But even if they are, there's certainly still a period of adjustment, both to the schedule, to the higher level. In the case of people going to Shiurim in Ivrit, right, there's a language issue, and it takes a while to acclimate. Because it takes a while to acclimate, both intellectually and culturally, and emotionally and spiritually, all these things, it's very challenging. So before you know it, you know, a third of your year, a half of your year is gone. The ambition that I outlined before, which is an aspiration, you know, not everybody walks out after, you know, 2 years or 5 years, you know, having you know, made amazing strides in all these areas. These are areas I've tried to identify that one should be focusing on and thinking about, and so on. But the ability even to scratch the surface in accomplishing some of these things, to make a hatkala, requires time and effort. And I think most cases, the second year is, you know, you already have some experience, you know, the people, the language is more familiar, right, the schedule is more familiar, more important, culturally, spiritually, etc. One is more attuned. And therefore, I think there's almost like I found in, you know, both family and Talmidim experiences and so on, that there's almost like a geometric progression at a certain point. I don't say that it begins day one of the second year, and that would be ridiculous, who would know. But it may begin, you know, after 6 months, or it may begin after a year and 2 months, I don't know. I know that at some point, being here and putting together the pieces, you know, becomes more than the sum of its parts. And at that point, it's not just more time, although it's also more time. And I think the, you know, level of growth is exponential and is very much worthwhile. In general, we found from our experience, you know, back on the other side of the ocean, in terms of receiving Talmidim, that Talmidim who have been in Yeshivot and Eretz Yisrael for 2 years are much more capable, or more easily capable. I think everybody's capable, but capable of confronting some of the challenges of being, you know, back in a college environment. Both their commitment, you know, to learning and their capacity, their, you know, just their level. All of these things make it more conducive for them. If a person's on a lower level and he's still struggling, you know, with some of the, you know, you know, the laning parts and so on, which can be a little frustrating. And, you know, he has to cope at the same time, you know, with calculus and, you know, philosophy papers, etc. So it's different than if, A, he's more committed and more dedicated. B, you know, he's already past the point where, you know, some of the laborious things are holding him back, and he's more in the, you know, pure, I would say pure enjoyment, but he's more, you know, in the actual Mokhapta Shel Torah, which is very stimulating. And we just find, you know, that both level-wise, dedication-wise, aptitude-wise, etc., people are just, by and large, you know, able to handle the challenges of the dual program in a much more successful way. So I had amazing Talmidim, I have to say, some from actually Yeshivat Har Etzion in the last couple of years. You know, people who were not able to stay a second year for various reasons, and I have to admit that in some of their cases, I would not have known that they didn't stay for, never mind a second year, maybe a third year. They're just, you know, absolutely, you know, a special, young, budding Talmidei Chachamim. Having said that, you know, I think the second year is a very, very important addition, and for most people, I think it makes a huge difference. Yeah.
Can Rosh Hashiva give us his thoughts on the Pal law?
On the?
Pal law, the one granting religious exemptions from the army.
Oh. You know what? I'm always hesitant to speak about local. I don't live here. And, I'm always a little bit hesitant. I'll be honest, I haven't seen the news in a week because I've been locked up in this place called, Machon Grus. Where we have no radios and no connection with the... I know there's a big to-do going on. I very much identify. I'll just say very briefly, but, again, I don't know what's going on in the latest, parts of the discussion. I don't mind saying publicly, I'm happy to say publicly, that I very strongly identify with, the world of yeshivot is there, and the responsibility of people who are dedicated to learning and to Torah on the highest level, to contribute to the country, to the security of the country, by going to the army. Ideologically, I'm fully identify with that. I think that the question of the exemption of yeshiva students is a very complicated issue, in the sense that it has a history, and even if ideologically people identify in a different way, you can't just rewrite history and ignore, a certain cultural divide that exists. And you have to find, mechanisms, that, take into account the reality of what has been, if you really want to change, that reality. So again, I'm not privy to the ins and outs, and I also feel a little presumptuous, I say, speaking about Israeli policy issues, because unfortunately I don't live here. But I don't know if that helps you or not. You can follow up into something more specific. I'm not sure what part of it you wanted me to address. Okay. Yeah.
What would you say should be a good balance between analyzing and thinking about an issue before you see the sources versus analyzing the sources themselves after reading them, both in terms of the Gemara and the Rishonim?
It's a very interesting, good question. First, I would make a comment.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Sure, absolutely. The question was, what do I think is the balance, the proper balance, between trying to, sketch out, I guess, you'll tell me if I'm accurately portraying your question, sketch out, what might be possible approaches in an what I would call an a priori way to a topic, to a sugya, as opposed to being influenced by the actual reading of the text and what the Gemara or the Rishonim say, both with respect to the Gemara and with respect to the Rishonim. Right? That's what you're asking. So I think the question comes from, I'm guessing, a certain level of experience, and that is if you go to different shiurim, you'll find you'll get very different impressions. Those who attend the shiurim of Mori Rabbi Rabar Lechenstein Shlita, sometimes get a very a priori, presentation. Because there's an issue, there's a topic, it's likely, that there would be, this kind of a valid approach, and an extreme in the other direction, maybe some sort of synthesis between the two. In other words, you're getting, a kind of prediction, or the categories are being drawn sometimes in the shiur before you're actually dealing with concrete, sources, Shonin, Shaka Vitaria, etc. You go to another shiur, and the Rebbe opens up the Gemara and he reads it, and then he opens up the Rambam, he reads the Ramban, and he's saying things seemingly in response to what he's reading. He's reacting. The question is, does this also... First I'm raising the question, then I'll discuss more of the issue. Does the presentation reflect a derech alimud, or does it reflect a presentation? If you went to the Rav Shiurim on a daily basis, he was very much in the second mold, not in the first. However, if you attended the Rav's Yortzeit Shiurim, right, it wasn't exactly like his daily Shiurim. Again, it wasn't so much an a priori presentation, but it was like a third type of presentation. The dramatic, Kasha, we have a problem, know, I have seven questions in the sugya. You know, what are we going to do? Here's the yesod, right? It answers not only the seven, probably answers the eight that we were about to ask as well. So, in the daily shir, he was learning one way, and in the art side shir, he was learning another way. Obviously, I mean, there's an element of presentation. And presentation is a function of both one's own inclination and personality, in which in some cases it reflects how you really learn or what you think is the character and nature of the Gemara or the Sugya. But it's also very much a function of your pedagogic view, right? And both objectively, what you want to accomplish, and particularly what you want to accomplish with a particular group. So when the Rav was giving the Ortzeit shir one way, he was giving the daily shir another way, you know, he was there was much more drama on the Ortzeit shir. It was a one-off, you know, event. And again, the drama part is, you know, when you have that kind of a presentation, seven questions, eight answers. You know, I'm being only a little facetious. But obviously it makes for an event, and a very stirring one, an unforgettable one, unforgettable in terms of the yesod as well. But more normally, when you want to teach Talmidim, and especially you're grinding through the sugyas day after day, so that's not the way that they're going to get the best methodology. You want to show them how you're reading the Rishon, how you're getting from the Rishon, and so on. Same is true, again, on another level. Again, I'm dealing with seasoned Talmidim, and I basically want to convey to them my ideas, my informationally, or my perspective, what's unique about my vision of the sugya, my position on this particular Rambam, right? I'm going to present things very differently than if I'm dealing with a group, right, where I want to emphasize methodology. How do you take the Gemara? How do you take an issue? How do you take a Rambam? And how do you analyze it? How do you examine it? You know, typically, and this is an example of many, you're going to spend much more time, and you're going to be much more, I guess, a priori, because you want to highlight, right, that you're not only doing this topic, but that it is it exemplifies, right, an analytical process. So I think the first thing we just need to be aware of is that I do think that in some cases presentations or presentation style reflects an inclination. But having said that, we need to be careful and qualify it somewhat, because the other factor is, who is the audience, what are my goals, what are my pedagogic goals, etc. In terms of the more objective question, which is what should be the balance, so it flows from the first issue a little bit. Meaning if the question, if we acknowledge that presentation, right, in addition to personal predilection, plays a role, which it must, you know, for any good pedagogue, so then if we attend a shiur and it's very a priori, right, we shouldn't necessarily assume, you know, that that's how the Magid shiur, you know, actually worked it out. I think likely that, you know, there's always a combination. I know in my own case, there's always a combination of the two. I don't know what the perfect balance is, but I know that there are advantages to both, and disadvantages if you do only one. The a priori way, the sketching out or the trying to anticipate, you know, the categories in advance, has the advantage of, number one, organizationally, it also is more comprehensive, or at least it creates a greater opportunity for comprehensiveness, because you try to anticipate, you know, all the points in the spectrum, the range in the topic. Moreover, by doing that, but really pouring mental energy, I don't mean doing it, you know, formulaically, like, oh, like somebody wrote a book some years ago, like, not exactly, again, but like, you know, how to do brisker lumnus, you know, in three easy steps, which I have to admit offended me greatly. Because I think it's just antithetical. The title is Aspira Minei Ubei. And, you know, any good brisker would certainly have agreed, or would agree. So what I mean is, not, you know, formulaically, but like each topic, trying to anticipate what the range, the legitimate range is going to be, you know, what the likely connections are going to be, etc. So then, having done that, you know, with a lot of mental energy, I think one is in a position to catch things that you might otherwise miss. You're very highly, like, sensitive to formulation. This is that one, that nuanced one that I was thinking about. You're very, very clued in and attuned you know, to differences not only in substance but in language, you know, in context. Ah, the Rambam puts it in Hilchos Mamrim, you know, and not in Hilchos Deos. I might not have seen sometimes that unless I thought it through and thought through the implications as well. At the same time, right, it would be presumptuous of us to think that we could outwit or outthink or comprehensively, you know, equally think all the great minds, great Talmidei Chachamim, Chachmei HaMesorah, in the Sugya. So you run the danger of, you know, these are your categories, if you're too rigid about it or too convinced about it. So then you're just, you know, you're not reading the Ramban, you're not reading the Rajba, you're certainly not open to what he is offering in a nuanced way, sometimes even in a clear way, because you're very committed to the system and you're just plugging in and imposing your categories on them. And in addition to being presumptuous, you've also missed the golden opportunity, right, to hear Shir from the Ramban. Right, what could be better? So I think there's a danger, even as there is a huge benefit. There's another benefit to doing it, which I should mention, which I think is ironic, but important, and that is, by sketching out what you think not only is the range, but what is likely to be linked to it, right, you are sometimes, you know, particularly impressed. It makes a much stronger impression on you when you're wrong. In other words, you read the Ramban, and he said, you know, pretty much your... what you thought was, you know, talui zeh bazeh, A leading to B, or A, you know, indispensable without B, but he holds A and he holds C. Right? Now, you can be more appreciative of the Ramban's Chiddush, right, if you've, you know, already, you know, put in some work and some energy into thinking about what the likely connections and linkages, you know, should be. On the other hand, again, if you, I pretty much said it, if you, you know, take the responsive approach, like I'm reading the Ramban with a clear mind, I'm reading the Shaka Vitaria without anything in my head, right? And, you know, let it bounce off of me and influence me. I'll be influenced by what he says, by the words that he uses, and so on. So obviously the advantage to that is you're hearing, you're trying to hear Shir from the Ramban. You're open to his, you know, vocabulary, his nuances, etc. The problem is that sometimes, as I say, without, you know, the a priori, you know, dimension, right, you just may miss what he's saying. You may just not understand it. The danger here isn't imposing your categories. The danger is that you're not fully sensitive, you know, to the possibilities, so that you're reading the Ramban like you read, you know, the Bahag. And if you'd realize that there was, you know, some nekuda, an important one though, you know, that is subtle yet critical, then, you know, you might have seen that that's where the Ramban differs with the Baha. So the conclusion is that I think in every analysis you have to do both. I think it's fine for people to have, you know, the propensity, you know, to do one better than or to prefer one over the other. And I think, despite what I said before about presentation playing a very important role, which I stand by, I think it's also true that you know, one's personality probably reflects the gray area, you know, beyond presentation, you know, where you find this kind of emphasis. And I think it's fine to have a range and say, I mostly do this, but I also balance it with that, and, or I mostly do that, but, you know, I maintain equilibrium with this. So you have to do both, and you have to be aware of doing both. I don't subscribe at all to the position that you're allowed to impose your views on the words of a Risha. In other words, we do care. You know, people often ask, you know, in these kind of fora, the question, do we care what the Rishon really meant? You know, do we only, you know, use it, you know, to convey our ideas? I think we really care what the Rishon meant. Otherwise, we're, number one, missing a golden opportunity. Certainly for speaking authoritatively in his name, either in Pesach Halacha, Kal Homer, but even conceptually to establish the legitimacy of a position, of course we care what he meant. I would just reformulate it and say that sometimes, you know, people say things and it's not the whole story. Sometimes the language they use, the formulations that they use, the place in which they categorize things, tell an additional story beyond the words that they say. Or sometimes somebody can be struggling with a formulation, and being aware that there might be more to it, you know, might be exactly what they were trying to say. Zechariah of the Bracha used to say this a lot about the Ramban. He thought that the Ramban was a seminal thinker, that he had, you know, amazing insight and intuition, and that, you know, there were some times when he had a breakthrough doctrine, but he just, you know, was a little either hesitant. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik thinks it's a little bit different. He thinks that the Ramban just wasn't such a talented, you know, subtle writer. And he thinks that his, you know, his the subtlety of his thought was greater than his, I guess, the subtlety of his pen. I don't know whether which is true, it doesn't really matter. But the idea that, you know, sometimes there's much more to a Ramban, you know, than what he says. That doesn't mean we ignore what he says. It just means that, you know, we also can take a wider view. But that's different than saying we don't care. He says it, we can stick it in the words. These are human texts. At the same time, even if the Ramban doesn't say what we think is in our range, we might look for some other Rishon to say it. In some cases, it might be legitimate for us to make the argument that it's a legitimate view. You know, usually we find somebody or echoes and somebody has to say it. Okay?
Would there be any difference in the Gemara and Rishonim?
I don't really think so. I think it's the same issue. Yeah.
When considering a career, should chinuch always be the first option that you consider? And then if it's right, then go into chinuch. And if it's not, then you proceed to other options.
I think that chinuch is obviously something which should, you know, be an option that people always think about. I don't know whether it's the default, meaning, you know, unless you hate it or can't do it, then you should do it. I think it's it's a default thing to consider, put it that way. And I think then you have to consider several different factors. Number one, you have to consider your proclivities, your talents, your interests. Is it something that you can do, that you can do effectively, that you can do, you know, with simcha? Theoretically, you know, you could say, well, this is a chiyuv, you know, it's why do we really care whether you like it or not? That's what's needed. I think there's also an element, before I get to that point, of the makom she'nish, which also have to assess, you know, how much the community needs. Does the community need more teachers at this level, more teachers at that level? Obviously that's a factor too. Oved Hashem should be thinking, you know, how in his life, in all aspects of his life, in his vocations, and also in his avocation, that he can, you know, reflect the values of Torah, be an Isha Halacha, and be an Oved Hashem. And therefore, everybody has to at least consider the possibility of vocationally, you know, teaching Torah, or being involved in Rabbanus, or some other aspect, leadership aspect, of Avodas Hashem. It would be unnatural not to be thinking at least about it, because, you know, it would imply that that aspect of your life is secondary to something else. But thinking about it, as I say, and making it, you know, the default, unless it's really terrible, those are two different things. And in addition to the Makom She'nish aspect, as I say, personal proclivity and personal simcha, I think, plays a very important role. Now, the reason personal simcha plays an important role, I think, is twofold. Number one, ideally, I mean, we want people, you know, to live productive and happy lives. We don't want them, you know, to be sacrificing for an ideal unless it's necessary. Again, if the Jewish community needs you to do this, you know, then that might be an exception. Assuming that there are other people who can do it, and the question is, you know, who should and who shouldn't, and whether it's good for you, right? So your personal happiness becomes an important issue. Moreover, there are very few people that I know of, you know, who are in such a madrega that they can suppress, you know, their personal sense of satisfaction and the nature of their personality, you know, for decades and decades of what is hopefully is a long life, you know, to do the right thing, you know, if it's something that makes them unhappy. We all have experienced, unfortunately, well, let me say it in a positive way first. Fortunately, we've all experienced great mechanchim, people who have inspired us, you know, people who we look at as role models, and, you know, whose, you know, contribution, the Talmidim, the Shinanta Levanecha, I can say, you know, without any kind of hesitation, for me, I think it's the only life for me. You know, it doesn't mean there are no frustrating moments. There are always frustrating moments. Anybody who's honest will tell you. No discouraging times. But so for me, this is something I always wanted to do. The relationship with Talmidim and teaching Torah is amazing. Schus, Vishnanta Levanecha, the idea of Bonim and Talmidim is something that I think is just an extraordinary concept. And I think it's really true. Once you're doing it, you really realize it. But having said that, we also, all of us probably in the room, or maybe some of you haven't, and you've been fortunate, have been exposed to Mechanchim, who went into the field with all the best intentions, and all the idealism that put them there, but did it in some cases out of a sense of duty, which makes it, in one respect, even more admirable, became very disillusioned, in some cases quickly, in some cases over time. They suffered burnout. And there's nothing more unhappy, than an unhappy mechanech. And the impact that he has on his Talmidim, in terms of Avas HaTorah and everything else, is obviously very problematic. So even if you were to say to somebody, it's your duty to go into chinuch, which I don't think it is the duty of every person, especially in a climate where there are other people to pick up the slack, I would just say practically, pragmatically, for 90% of the population, it doesn't work. It's better to appeal to people to go into chinuch or rabbanus or avodas Hashem for selfish reasons than for selfless reasons. In other words, if Talmud will ask me, what do you think? Should I go into this? I'll say to him, if this is your passion, this is your sense of destiny, you have to look at it and say, is there anything else that I would want better to be doing? If this is what brings you meaning in your life and purpose, so then it's an amazing thing. And if it's not the most lucrative profession in the world, right. So the way to look at it is, from a selfish point of view, I'd rather have a less lucrative profession, but one which I believe in, and which satisfies my sense of aspiration, even selfishly. I'd like to have both, right? But I'd rather choose, meaning and purpose and something that I love, than drudgery with a big salary. So I'd rather appeal to Talmidim or people who are considering chinuch and rabbanus in terms of that aspect of their idealism. Is this their sense of destiny? Is this something that that they can't do without? And I very much encourage people, notwithstanding other challenges and hardships, assuming that there are jobs and other such things, you always want to give responsible advice and so on. But people who want to live a life of chinuch, I think it's amazing for one's family and one's self. And I know most of the chanukim and rabbanim that I know are very happy. They made these decisions and the impact that they've had on others, and I'd rather appeal on that grounds than the other. Having said that, I think it's very important that people who decide that, let's say they have some other calling, that is idealistic and pressing. They want to be a doctor, they want to be a social worker, they want to be some sort of leader in the community, or a scientist who wants to do research, study the Bria. I think those are all very noble professions. Even the more neutral professions, obviously some people, enjoy them or they want the benefits of them. But I would say to people in those circumstances that it's very critical to find an outlet also to practice chinuch and harbatzas hatorah, whether it be in your community, certainly in the context of your family. One should be a leader both in guiding the destiny of communities as well as in Talmud Torah itself. And I know many people who are lawyers, who are doctors, who also went on to receive smicha. I think that's a very important thing to do if one can do it. At the same time, people who give shiurim in their communities, people who are involved in a very constructive way, in some cases, every bit as much important as the mechanchim and the rabbanim. So, or leadership in other senses. So, my focus is trying to find what's best for an individual, given some of these considerations, and to try to channel that person's own talents in a way that, I think the smorgasbord is over? in a way that really is consistent, with Limaratem Osam and Vishnanta Levanecha, if not in formal contexts, in another context. I remember when I was a student in Yeshivat HaRetzion, so we didn't have this you know, high-tech, state-of-the-art building. You know, we were down there a little bit, and there were blackouts, like, you know, every 2 weeks or so. And whenever there was a blackout, so one of the ramen, you know, would pop up and give a shiur, and he had a captive audience. So I don't know whether this point is to continue that tradition or not. But either way, we have room, we have time for another couple of questions. Yeah.
I'm following up on the a priori question of learning. Mm-hmm. What should one do? What should one's response be if he thinks of certain things that are not, and then not presented in later generations, both in terms of rishonim and achronim?
Say that one more time.
What should one's response be if he thinks of certain things on a sugya mm-hmm. that are then not presented in later generations, both in terms of rishonim and achronim?
Okay, so obviously, you know, you want to find, you know, what you're saying, or something like what you're saying, or an echo of what you're saying in some authoritative source. That's always very comforting and definitely very validating. Two things. Number one, I would say there's a huge difference between Psak Halacha and Talmud Torah. If you're talking about Psak Halacha, depending on, if you're, you know, Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so, you know, if your conviction, you know, leads you to a conclusion that has no foundation or basis, you know, then, you know, again, if you write, if you're Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so from my point of view, you know, there's an authoritative source. If you are Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so I guess you have to be very, very confident that the totality of your learning, you know, which is based on, you know, being immersed in the Mesorah and being a walking Sefer Torah, is ad kedei kach, that you're confident that, you know, even though you haven't found this, you've really reached, you know, truth, and to such an extent, you know, that the people can rely on this halacha l'maisa. If you look in the, you know, works of the great poskim, you'll find a lot of chidushim. I mentioned Rav Moshe Feinstein because he's an amazing mechadesh in Psak, and he's very independent. Now, he's not quoting a thousand tshuvas, you know, of intervening years. But, you know, the svaras that he suggests are by and large rooted, you know, in categories that are very well known to us. You know, his boldness is an application. Mashal Ma Davar Dome, you know, to connect, you know, the previous Dvar Torah, you know, I guess, to some of the questions, you know, is Purim Baltosif, or is Purim, once you understand it deeper, you know, Kimu Vekiblu, you know, Kimu Masha Kiblu Kvar. But in Psak Halacha, you know, certainly for the rest of us who aren't on that Madrega, if you can't find an authoritative source, and even if you find one, you know, there are whole rules, Kimli and all sorts of other, you know, in the Elu Velu Divrei Elokim Chayim range for Psak Halacha, you have to be much more rigorous and have a much stronger foundation, especially if we're talking about, you know, to use the Moshe Rabbeinu Yisro dialogue terminology, you know, the Dvarim HaChashuvim and the Dvarim HaGedolim, you know, the things that, you know, really affect other people or are consequential in terms of Onshim, you know, and so on. If we're talking about Kaddish Tiskabel, then you want to implement your Svara, and you're very certain about it. Again, I always, for some reason, pick on Kaddish Tiskabel, but Kaddish Tiskabel is very important too, so I'm not... what I mean is, not Agunas and not Chil Shabbos. You know, obviously, you know, part of the consideration would be what area we're talking about. But by and large, when it comes to Psak Halacha, the need to have an authoritative makar obviously is much, much greater. When it comes to Talmud Torah, the giving of a shir, the spreading of an idea, I don't think that anything goes either, because ideas are powerful, they influence other things. Again, I've been talking about the rippling across the system of, you know, a certain idea or a certain practice. You know, everything is influential. So I think, you know, even ideas, even in theoretical ideas in Talmud Torah, in Taurus and Kachim that don't apply Bismanenu, you know, even they you have to be careful about, because we want to avoid Ziyuf HaTorah. We're interested in looking for MS. We can believe that there's a range, and there can be things that are out of that range. Even a wide range, right, has, you know, its terminus. And we have to be very careful about that as well. We have to be careful, as I said before, not to impose certain ideas on the words of or the shitas of people who don't believe them. Except that in certain cases, the shita might be separate or independent from its rationale and explanation. Sometimes you have a rishon, came to a certain conclusion based on the evidence of Makoros, etc., and now he's adding an explanation. And the conclusion may be independent of the explanation. And sometimes the explanation may be independent of the conclusion. Meaning a Havamina in a Gemara, a suggestion of the Ramban. You know, these are also things that are important in the discourse of Torah Shabbat. So what I'm saying is there is a range of things. Obviously, the more one is trained as a Talmud Chacham and has a good instinct and experience and reverence to for real Makoros, etc., the more legitimate one's own position and own opinion is. We find many times, both in Rishonim and Achronim, taken in their context, did the Ramban say things that, you know, no one had said before him, of course, otherwise we wouldn't be quoting them in the name of the Ramban. You know, and so did the Pnei Yoshua, and so did, and I still have to leave in a couple minutes, and so did Rav Chaim. However, there's a certain foundation for these things. Every Chiddush of the Pnei Yoshua and every Chiddush of Rav Chaim, you know, is built on, you know, decades, you know, of immersion in Torah, and, you know, living and breathing the system. I always like to, quote the Rav's ideas, you know, in Isha Halacha. You know, he didn't formulate it this way or for this purpose, but, you know, in a sense, what the Rav describes in Isha Halacha kind of solves the, you know, the conundrum or adds a wrinkle to the issue of, of Chiddush and Kol Ma'aseh Talmud Vasa Kasa L'Chadesh Ne'emar L'Moshe Misina. Because what he describes in Isha Halacha is somebody who surrenders to the system and to the categories of the system. He becomes, you know, batel to them. He gives up his own independence in the sense that he's really trying to reconstruct and understand the Makoros as an Eved Hashem. At the same time, once he does that, he becomes an insider who is then able to articulate Chidushim. And nothing is more admired, you know, in Lithuanian circles, you know, than a proper Chiddush. But a proper Chiddush can only be articulated by an insider, by somebody who isn't imposing other things from the outside, as much as possible, obviously. He's bringing himself and his proclivities and his experience. There's nothing wrong with that. But he's trying to integrate it into the system of halakha. Then, with that prior submission, right, the Chiddush, the Ha'ara, is no longer, you know, something which comes out of the air. We might not find that exact idea, but it's built on a comment of the Ramban, a Havamina of the Gemara, other cumulative evidence, parallels, etc. So it's a complicated answer to a complicated question. I think there are times, certainly in Talmud Torah, when it's absolutely legitimate to say one's own svara, especially if it coheres with and adds to, and especially if it's built on, you know, concepts that are part of the system. Okay, so we're going to stop now. Again, Ot Chazon LaMoed, I'm sorry that there isn't enough time. It's always a pleasure to be here. And just wish all of you Hatzlacha the rest of the year. You should continue to be Matzliach in your learning. Thank you.